Today, housing affordability, misdirection. Property signs to the 13th of September 2021. Hello, Guinness Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Worth noting this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And just a quick reminder that tomorrow, Tuesday, I'll be joined by Megan Wells on my live at 8 p.m. Sydney time. We're going to be discussing the Queensland property market and, of course, looking at Brisbane and beyond Brisbane. And given all the interest in Brisbane and the surrounding areas, it'll be a very interesting show. So join me at 8 p.m. Sydney time and you can ask a question live. So today, the 13th, the latest government inquiry into housing affordability closes. In fact, I just made my own submission. Once it's been approved by the committee, I'll share more about it. Of course, this particular one is scoped to look at so-called supply-side issues and housing affordability, so it's missing the big elephant in the room. And there was some interesting commentary from other submissions, which is worth going through. Home ownership in Australia is a centre pillar of the Australian dream, but it's one that's increasingly unattainable for first home buyers as housing affordability spirals out of control. While property prices are on the up and up, the CEOs of Westpac and NAB have been speaking openly about the housing affordability crisis, with Westpac CEO Peter King telling Parliament that it was pretty stretched. A new parliamentary inquiry into housing affordability and supply in Australia will close submissions today, with Liberal MP Jason Falinski chairing. Leading economist Saul Eslake is one of the figures who's already written a submission to the inquiry. As a former ANZ chief economist and a former Treasury staffer, few Australians know more about the economics of real estate in Australia, and Australian brokers spoke to him directly about his submission and where and how the housing market is failing first home buyers. Housing policy in Australia has been failing for 50 years, explained Eslake. If, by the objectives of housing policy, you mean that governments want to preserve the high levels of home ownership that the baby boomer generation has enjoyed, and that those who aren't able to aspire to home ownership don't have to live with high levels of rental stress. I would argue that the two problems are interrelated. We've seen a steady decline in the home ownership rate since it peaked at 72% in 1956, and especially since the early 1990s, to the point where the home ownership rate in the 2016 census was the lowest it's been since 1954. Among people under 40, it's fallen to the lowest it's been since 1947. I suspect that when the results of the 2021 census, which we only recently completed, are released next year, they will show a further decline in the home ownership rate over the last 5 years. What we've got is home ownership increasingly concentrated among those 50 and over, a significant cohort of people in their 20s and 30s who, in previous generations, would have been able to buy their own homes, but who instead aren't able to. They are therefore forced to rent, and for longer, in some cases, for the rest of their lives. They have sufficient incomes to be able to rent in the private sector, but in doing so, they push up rents, making life even more difficult for the cohort of Australians who, both in previous generations and in this one, have never had any realistic aspiration to home ownership. Australia's housing affordability crisis, according to Eslake, stems from the traditional balance of supply and demand. Because governments since the 1980s have gradually stepped away from the provision of social housing, there simply isn't enough affordable social housing now to meet anything like the demand for it from people who would never have had any realistic aspiration of acquiring their own home, he said. Beginning in 1964 with the first home savings grant, the focus of government policy at federal, state and local levels and under governments of both political persuasions has shifted away from boosting supply towards inflating demand and constraining supply. Every time house prices look like falling, government stumps up with ever-increasing and more generously defined grants to would-be first home buyers, which do nothing to increase the home ownership rate but inflate the price of existing houses and end up in the pocket of either vendors or in the profit margins of builders and land developers. through doing nothing about the tax preferences for investors, indeed by effectively cutting capital gains tax in 1999, making them more generous, Australia has something like 15% of all taxpayers being landlords, which is one of the highest rates in the world. Defenders of tax preferences for property investors say that it helps to increase the supply of rental housing. What it actually does, because investors crowd would-be first home buyers out of the market because their tax preferences makes it easier for them to service debt. What that does is it creates demand for rental housing rather than necessarily increase the supply of it, especially when you factor in that a significant amount of investor purchases are for existing properties rather than new ones. At the same time, state and local governments, particularly New South Wales, have made it harder, more expensive and more time-consuming to do brownfield developments, while governments around the country have in effect forced those taxes and charges onto would-be buyers because of the increased house prices. We've ended up in a bit of a mess. The thing that I can't get away from is that for all the crocodile tears from politicians shed about the difficulties that would-be first home buyers face in getting their first steps on the property ladder, they keep doing things that make it that hard. According to Westlake, there is little political will to solve the housing affordability crisis because in Australia, homeowners vastly outnumber potential first home buyers. Why would they do that, asks Westlake. I think it's because deep down they know that in any given year there'll be around 100,000 people who succeed in becoming first home buyers. They, up until the moment that they do succeed, want the government to do things that constrain house prices. But when they do succeed, they will join the 11 million Australians who own at least one property, and within that, the 2 million who own two or more properties. The last thing that these 11 million, and especially those 2 million, want the government to do is anything that slows down or halts the rate of property price inflation. On the one hand, maybe 100,000 or so people who want the government to do things that stop the inflation of property prices, and on the other hand, 11 million that want the government to keep property prices going higher. Even the dumbest of our politicians can do that math, as the Americans say, and ultimately they do it every time they think there is about to be an issue. And elsewhere, Australians are more likely to purchase a property sight unseen than they are a pet, vehicle or a boat, according to new data from Canstar. A new Canstar survey of 1,036 Australians revealed that 11% would be willing to purchase a property for owner-occupied or investment purposes without viewing it in person, whereas just 10% would do the same for a vehicle and 8% for a pet. The results also found that 8% of Australians would commit to a rental property without inspecting it in person, while just 5% would do the same thing for a vote. Effie Zachos, Canstar's editor-at-large, says one of the biggest impacts of the pandemic has been our rapid digital adoption. Australians are working, socialising and shopping online more than ever before, and this has resulted in some interesting buying trends, especially within the property market. Since the start of the pandemic, surging house prices in capital cities have sparked a regional property boom, with buyers abandoning the big smoke in favour of affordable housing and less restrictions. But regional prices are now creeping up, fueling a growing sense of urgency among buyers desperate to crack the market. With nearly half the population now in lockdown, impacted buyers are unable to travel interstate or even outside their local government areas to inspect a home. That leaves them with little choice but to go online, and some real estate agents have reported an increase in buyers competing for properties via virtual auctions. If you are considering buying a home sight unseen or even committing to a rental, it's imperative to do your research beforehand though. A property is a huge financial commitment regardless of whether you intend to live in it yourself or use it for an investment purpose. Interestingly, Australians are slightly cagier about buying a pet sight unseen. The potential for behavioural issues, underlying health problems or even being scammed are likely the biggest underlying factors here. And the research also found that just 39% of Australians would be willing to purchase groceries online as opposed to in person, while 37% would do the same for clothing, and just over a third, at 35%, said they wouldn't be willing to purchase anything without seeing it person first. When it comes to buying sight unseen, the real trick, apart from extensive research, is to listen to your gut instinct, they said. If you're getting a bad feeling about something, then you're probably spot on, be it a property or a pet. Don't let the notion of love at first sight come to bite you later, Zahos said. In fact, they suggested five things to consider before buying a property sight unseen. Make the most of virtual tools, because we're well and truly living in the digital age, so use this to your advantage. If you're interested in the property, you can view the home and its surroundings via Google Street View. Suburb profiles from reputable sources can provide a good indication of buying trends and demographics in the area, and virtual inspections, appointment-based video tours, and floor plans are king. Then consider using a buyer's agent. They can scope out a property on your behalf or recommend other properties in the area based on your preferences, and they can even negotiate or bid at auction on your behalf. But bear in mind that they can be expensive, which can push up your buying costs. Then get a second opinion. If your friends or relatives are living in the area, ask them to view the property for you as well. They might not necessarily have the same professional knowledge as a buyer's agent, but they will be more likely to give you their honest opinion, good or bad. Next, don't skimp on building or pest inspections. If you're buying sight unseen, it's even more important to do your due diligence. The more boots you can get on the ground beforehand, the better. A building inspection will check for things like structural defects, while a pest inspection will look for evidence of termites or pre-existing pest damage. This can be the difference between buying your dream home and buying into a nightmare. And then be realistic. At the end of the day, buying a property without viewing it in person is always a risk, regardless of how much research you've done behind the scenes. Given it's likely to be one of the most expensive purchases in your life, you will want to be sure you've ticked off every possible checklist before jumping in. Even then, there's something to be said about seeing it for yourself where the property sits. Now, Northern Beach house prices are rising at over $10,000 a week, according to one local real estate expert, making the Sydney region one of the best places to invest in property in Australia. Strand Property Group, a buyer's agency based in French's Forest, charted that the median property price in the Northern Beaches has risen 15.1% in just 6 months, resulting in $290,000 being added to the price of houses in that time period. Michael Ozitt, director of Strand, said that the lifestyle attractions of the Northern Beaches were even more popular now that commuting to the CBD was no longer required for a large portion of the Sydney workforce. It's always been a highly desirable area, even before the pandemic, he said. It attracts a lot of people who want to be close to lifestyle features such as bush and the beach, as well as places like Manly and all the amenities that comes with that. But what we found is a huge shift in the last 18 months where people are spending more time at home and have made the decision to live in a more desirable location. We've seen people come from out of area to buy or to rent on the northern beaches, in particular from the eastern suburbs, because while they have beaches there, the properties are generally bigger up here. We've also seen a lot from the inner west, and of course, there's a higher demand than there are properties for sale. For property investors, the low vacancy rates on the northern beaches, allied with the livability factors, have made buying a property in Manly, Narrabeen and other suburbs a great proposition. The vacancy rate across the whole of Sydney rose last year and has tightened since, but there's still hot spots in the city that have higher rates, whether student accommodation and inner-city accommodation, said Ozitt. But apartments and houses on the northern beaches have a very low vacancy rate. In some suburbs, it's around 1%, when we look at 3% as equilibrium. What has happened in the last 12 months is that investors have taken the decision to sell investment properties either to cash in on the rise in price or because people have become more risk averse and have cashed in because of uncertainty. Thus, the number of investment properties have reduced while the number of tenants is up, which has put pressure on rental stock. That has seen rents go up each month while vacancy rates hold tight. Yields are comparatively low to other places in Sydney or wider across Australia, but that's really a factor of price growth. We're starting to see that shift now. Tenants want to live here because of the lifestyle reasons, and landlords want to invest here because of that long-term capital growth and perennial demand. APRA has expressed concern with an uptick in high debt-to-income lending, but has said there will be no intervention for now. Reflecting on the mortgage market in recent months, APRA Chair Wayne Byers told the House of Economic Standing Committee on Economics on Friday that there was a mixed picture in the latest risk metrics. As captured in recent quarterly statistics from the regulator, outstanding housing credit hit $1.9 trillion in June. That's 4.7% more than a year before. New home loans New home loans during the 3 months to June came in at $156.2 billion, with 70.6% taken up by owner-occupiers and 27.8% being investors. Investors' lending had declined by 1.4% from the year before, while owner-occupiers rose 1.5%. But there's been a 5.8 percentage point rise in lending with a high debt-to-income ratio, six times or more, up to 21.9%. Mr. Byers noted at the same time other risk metrics fell, including the share of lending with high loan-to-value ratios, which was down by 0.6% to 8.6%. Well, the plight, as I said, is a complex picture. We're weighing up a raft of different considerations. There are risk metrics that tell us different things, Byers told the committee. The issue of concern and present is that there is an increase in high debt-to-income lending, but it's offset against a number of other metrics which are going in a more positive direction from a prudential perspective. And he added the regulator is yet to see any signs of standards deteriorating, with balance sheets still strong and no obvious poor quality lending going on. The RBA had previously indicated that it is watching the housing and mortgage markets and working with APRA to collect data on the banks. Speaking to the committee about a month ago, RBA Governor Lowe said he is yet to see any sign of erosion in lending standards, but the regulators have begun to consider what tools they should use to intervene should they deem it necessary. Such policies, listed by Dr. Lowe, could involve raising the minimum interest rate that banks use for home loans, as well as restrictions around portfolio LVR or debt to income. The key issue of present that we're watching is less prudential and more macro. It's really looking at household debt levels and the extent to which there is potential for household debt levels to run well ahead of income growth for an extended period, Byers said on Friday. And I think the governor said he would be uncomfortable with that, and I would also be uncomfortable with that. Now, Chief Executive Ross McEwan also appeared before the committee the day before APRA last week when he stated he would recommend the regulator wait for the spring house sales season and for a few months to play out post-lockdown before taking any next steps. Both McEwan and Westpac CEO Peter King, who also appeared last Thursday, acknowledged rocketing house prices, with Mr. King conceding housing affordability is stretched. Mr. McEwan stated NAB would have major concerns if the price rise continued. When asked about Mr. McEwan's suggestion to wait out the traditionally busy spring period of property sales, Byers indicated a wariness about the potential movement of house prices. Well, certainly, we're cautious of the current environment and the way it could play out, he said. If you'd asked how to stop house price inflation in pre-pandemic times, pausing international immigration and building a lot of new houses would have been high on the list. But Domain featured a piece by Professor Nicole Gurran, the University of Sydney, and Professor Peter Phipps, the University of Sydney. According to the dominant narratives, population growth has driven demand for residential property, while planning and red tape have prevented the supply response. For many commentators, housing is like bananas, with price rising and falling in response to supply and demand. Last year, we saw just how simplistic those claims really are. The number of new migrants and returnees to Australia fell by 244,000 people, but prices continue to rise. Houses earned more than wages over the past 12 months. Sydney, Melbourne experienced the sharpest decreases in population growth due to the closure of international borders and regional migration, from about 2% growth in 2018-19 to 0.2% contraction in 2021. But home values rose 21% and 13% respectively over the 12 months to August, based on CoreLogic data, propelled by government grants, concessions and low interest rates. In theory, rising house prices would simulate a supply response in a competitive market, which in turn would moderate prices. In practice, though, housing production is sticky. New dwellings take time to build and are costly to finance. This is a particular issue for large apartment buildings, with finance often not being available until the developers pre-sold the majority of apartments. Even so, pre-pandemic rates of new housing production reached historic highs in Australia. According to the latest data, at 2% per annum, Australia's rate of housing production relative to the existing stock is still well above the OECD average. As the federal government begins another inquiry into housing affordability and supply, with submissions due today, the federal government always likes talking about supply because they can shift the blame for housing affordability issues to state and local levels. It's important to remember that the economics of housing is different to that of bananas. This is because housing is a financial asset as well as a consumption good. So the largest impact on house prices is the supply and price of finance, not new dwellings. If the federal government is interested in which supply issues are important, an increase in the amount of affordable rental supply would address ongoing housing stress and overcrowding in the major cities and rising rates of homelessness in the regional areas. However, the Commonwealth appears to have turned its back on social housing, limiting the capacity of the states in what has traditionally been a joint responsibility. This impression was reinforced recently by MP Jason Falesky, who is leading the Commonwealth's inquiry deriding social housing at a recent property industry forum by saying the issue that you have is social housing is housing commission. Nevertheless, some of the government responses during the pandemic offer new promise. Accommodation was provided for people experiencing homelessness, while increased income support enables some renters to access better housing or to alleviate financial stress. Moratoriums on rental evictions have demonstrated the need for increased tenure security in the private rental sector. Building on these lessons, it's time to enact a national housing policy with a clear set of objectives to ensure that all sectors of the population have access to affordable and appropriate homes. Rather than rhetorical promises to solve house price inflation through new supply, the national housing strategy should emphasise stable rates of housing construction attuned to changing population needs. Recognising calls from industry in both non-profit and for-profit sectors, the national approach would expand the social housing stock, enable new models of housing provision, such as shared equity and low-cost home ownership. Support for Aboriginal housing providers and organisations, including improving the conditions and maintenance arrangements of existing housing stock, would be integral. Improving the quality of existing housing and residential communities through sustainable retrofit and renewal programmes should replace narrow supply agendas, and targets for climate resilience should complement targets for new dwellings. For the growing number of Australians renting in the private sector, improve rental protections, for instance, an end to no-fault evictions is critical, and increased support for low-income earners is long overdue. None of these strategies require or would even cause house prices to fall. That may be lucky, because despite the hand-wringing, it's clear that politicians don't want them to, nor do the producers who claim that planning rather than profit maximisation holds back housing production rates. So you can see just how complicated the issue of housing affordability is and why looking at just supply-side issues, which is what this current inquiry is all about, is so myopic. In fact, I would say it's a misdirection. They're wanting you to look over here when, in fact, the real issues relating to credit and other broader macroeconomic issues are over there. But, of course, that would put light back on the federal government. Of course, what they want to do is to pass the buck back to the states and say that housing affordability is a supply problem, which is a state problem. Seen that before. I'm sure we'll see it again. Now, if you're buying your home in Sydney's contentious market, you don't need to stand alone. This is the time you need to have Edwin Almeida from Ribbon Property Consultants standing alongside you. Buying a property is both challenging and adversarial. The vendor has a professional on their side. Emotions run high, price discovery and price transparency are hard to find, and then there's the wasted time and financial investments that you make. Edwin understands your needs, so why not engage a licensed professional to stand alongside you? With RPC, you know you have experience, knowledge, and master negotiators looking after your best interests. So shoot Ribbon an email at info@ribbonproperty.com.au. And if you use the promo code DFAWTW/Martin, you can get a 10% discount offer. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.